This is the Saturday Night Live Day of Sobriety number 22, held on June 4th, 1994, at El Paseo Shopping Center, room 120 in San Jose, California. The 5 o'clock speaker is Joyce Y. of Reno, Nevada. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL tape library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Well, I am Joyce, and I'm an alcoholic. I wanted to get up and say I'm Susie, and I'm an alcoholic after that saga of Susie. Can you hear me? Okay. Oh, man, that was a hard act to follow. I mean, you know, what a message. It's a good thing I didn't see that when I was new, because the way it affects me now. I want to thank Mary and Diane and Perry and the group and a committee, if there is one, for inviting Fred and I to be here today. I accepted for both of us, and so I almost got killed on the way down here for not checking with Fred to let him give a yes. But you might have already figured out, if you heard Fred earlier this afternoon, that I don't check in a lot about what I'm supposed to do. I just kind of do it, and like announcing that we're going to get married and telling him later. But I also want to share a little bit this evening about what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm like now, simply because that's what the book instructs me to do, and nowadays I try to follow directions a little bit more than I used to. And besides that, I don't think people can really appreciate what I'm like today if they don't know what I used to be like, especially those that know me well, because sometimes I'm not that much better. I just don't drink for doing it all. And so I want to back up a little bit, too, and share what I was that came to Alcoholics Anonymous and some of the reasons why, and other things that go on there as I ended up here, and it doesn't really matter why. I just got here. I also was born in Kansas, about 150 miles away from Fred, but I didn't know that at the time. I am the oldest of eight children, born to an alcoholic father and a born-again, spirit-filled, Bible-thumping, tongue-speaking Christian mother. And I probably wouldn't have to say any more for you to understand why I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was schizophrenic from the get-go. You know, I was running to the altar when they played Just As I Am and wishing I could go to the bar and have a drink with my dad. You know, so I was confused from the gate. I was never happy to be the oldest of eight kids, and yet I loved all my brothers and sisters. I didn't want anything bad to happen to them, but I was their backup mother, and I resented that. I was an adult before I was ever a child. When I was 9 years old, I was taking laundry to school on the school bus and taking the day off and doing laundry and then hauling it all back home. So I didn't have a real start as I look back on it, and I'm a little bit more clear about why I was confused about things, about values, about belief systems, about what to do with life. However, I doubt that that has very little, if anything, to do with the fact that I turned out to be an alcoholic. I have no idea why I'm an alcoholic. I know that the educators say nowadays if your mother or father are an alcoholic, there's a 25% chance you will be. If your mother and father are an alcoholic, there's a 50% chance you will be. I don't know what the chances are if your great-grandfather, your grandfather, your father, yourself, and your daughter are alcoholics, you know. But I know I came from a long line of alcoholics. That's just my story. I'm not sure it has anything to do with anything, except that I wasn't the first black sheep in the family, so psychologically that made me feel a little better. But, you know, I had a sister who's 13 months younger than I am, and she never went through the mental gymnastics about being raised in the family on a turkey farm in Kansas, and the shame and the apologizing for how she grew up and where she was raised and who her parents were that I had. And I don't know if I came born with shame or where I picked it up, you know, if I read the wrong book or saw the wrong movie or what happened. But I know that she never went through that. We were raised in the same environment, so it tends to make me believe that there was something going on in me that was not going on in her. And I just went on that basis, that it was not about where we were raised and who we grew up with and how many times we got beat with the buckle end of a belt or how much cow poop we had to tromp through to get the chores done before we went to school or wearing chicken feed sack dresses that Mama made and put lace and ribbons on them and called them designer dresses. That's what they call them today. I called it a piece of shit with a ribbon stuck on it in my day. And so I could give you the saga of Joyce, you know, but in to me, it's still part of it is a saga. I think someday it will make a very quaint, interesting, exciting book, but not till I've lived it all and am about to die. So I'm putting it in journals, and maybe my granddaughter will write it when she's the only one that has the right to open my diaries. I file them away each year in a trunk and lock it, and I've left them to her in my will, and I don't want them read until I'm dead. So that's my story. My real story is in that trunk, and she can tell it to you after I'm 6 feet under. So I didn't know anything about being an alcoholic. I had some attitudes about it. I had some preconceived ideas about it. I had some holier-than-thou self-righteous ideas that had been put in my head by Sunday school teachers and preachers about what an alcoholic was that went something like, you know, you had to be approximately 60 years old, have a 3 weeks growth of beard, be living in a preferably black or army green trench coat that you'd vomited on and peed on for about a half a year, and if you were really bad drunk, you were flashing people. If not, you hadn't hit bottom yet. With a folded-up Kleenex box for a mattress under the bridge. And I hadn't done any of those things. That was not me. Where we come up with our preconceived notions about what alcoholism is, I'm really not sure, because other people lived in the same society I did, and they didn't think that that was a drunk at all. My sister thought a drunk was somebody who went out and had 3 beers and came back in smelling like beer, having the smell of beer on their breath. And so even our ideas, our old ideas, are not the same. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I still did not believe that I was an alcoholic. I was 24 years old. I still had never had a 3 weeks growth of beard. I still had not slept more than a week or so on a cardboard box, and it wasn't under a bridge anyway. It was out behind the bar. And that's the way we do, you know. I compared everything that I had done to everything that you had done, and I had not done it yet exactly like that. And so, therefore, I wasn't an alcoholic. I did not know anything about lower companions. I was a lower companion, so how was I going to know what a lower companion was? Early on in my life, I started looking for solutions that I know now kind of reek of alcoholic tendencies and characteristics and personality traits, if there is such a thing. I don't know if there is an alcoholic personality. I know I'm an alcoholic and I have a personality, so I have an alcoholic personality. Other than that, I don't know if we're that different than other human beings or not. I've seen a lot of non-alcoholic people out there that I'd like to give the 12 steps to and spend about 2 years sponsoring them, you know. So maybe alcohol gives us a reason to get it together and need something to change our lives. At any rate, I started looking for solutions to the problems in my life outside myself real early in my life. I must have been about 4 years old. The first things that I found a solution in were books. I was an avid reader. By the time I was in the first grade, I could read. And I buried myself in books. And today I watched that play, and I know what I want to be when I grow up. I'll give you one guess. I want to play Susie in Susie the South. I always wanted to be the star, the starlet, the director. I was the actor that was always trying to be the director that the big book talks about. And I wanted out of my dilemma, but I had no idea how to get out. So rather than face reality, I would take any way out I could get. I decided by the time I was 9 that I wanted to be a sunbeam for Jesus. I was going to get saved, baptized all in the same afternoon, and be off to Africa to deliver little black babies by the time I was 12. And that was my life. I never got to Africa. I've never delivered a black baby yet. I still want to do that someday, maybe even in Africa, but I haven't done it yet. And by the time I was 12 or 13, I knew that was never going to happen because I was in Sunday school and church paying attention, more attention to the boys than I did the preacher, and I knew that's not what missionaries did. And so I started chasing the first guy that would have me, and in those days, the only requirement to have a relationship with me was to want to. you wanted to, you had me. That's it. No complicated deal. So this sadistic maniac came along looking for a victim, and I was looking for a villain, and so we had no problem getting together, you know. He was a jerk, and I needed a jerk in my life, and so we got together and lived unhappily ever after until we almost died together. And that's what happens when I'm on the self-will run riot track. Now, I knew about what I thought were spiritual principles. I was taken to Sunday school when I was 10 days old. I was at the altar every other Sunday. I was baptized a half a dozen times because it felt good, and anything that felt good, I did it again and again and again and again. And if we had a swimming pool here, I'd probably be baptized again if anybody suggested it, because it was nice. You know, every time I did that, it felt right. And I just buried my head deeper and deeper in denial. The first substance that I ever took to obliterate myself was not alcohol. I used to not tell my story honestly because I got my hands slapped for talking about drugs in Alcoholics Anonymous, and so now I just say that I am an alcoholic who used drugs alcoholically. And I cover it that way, and if you don't like it, sorry, it's my story, it's my hour, it's the way it went. You can talk about me after the meeting. How dare she use that big bad D word in AA. But anyway, I took drugs, and I was about 5 years old when I started drinking Paregoric, and then I drank Romalar cough syrup and took Midol and aspirin and whatever I could get my hands on, and shaving lotion and perfume and vanilla extract and whatever would take me out of it. However, I wouldn't take a drink of alcohol because I was a good girl, and good girls don't drink. And they do everything else, but they don't drink. And I was teaching Sunday school, and I was singing in the choir, and I was going to vacation Bible school, and I was teaching vacation Bible school, and I was still kind of a sunbeam for Jesus. I mean, I didn't glow all the time, but I was a sunbeam. And so I was not going to be drinking. But that eventually changed, too. And after I got married to this villain and had my 2.3 children with the white picket fence, the company truck, you know, the landscaping all done just right. I was poking pills down my ears to keep them safe so nobody could get them away from me, sticking them in lipstick tubes and cold cream jars and everything else, and then eating the cold cream to get the drugs. But I did not think I had a problem. And I had two major surgeries that I didn't need to have so that I could be in the hospital and get drugs. Now, I didn't know that at the time, you know. I mean, that had to take some inventory, but I want you to know I wasn't that rigorously honest from the gate. It is not real easy to walk in and say I'm missing a couple of ovaries because I needed some drugs. No, that's what I did. I stole a physician's desk reference from a nurse friend and learned to read symptoms and go in and complain of them and so that I would get the right drug. I was seeing five doctors in three different states. Anybody here who's done that, please don't take these ideas that you may not have tried yet and do what I did with them. Because every new idea I heard in my first 3 years in sobriety, if I hadn't done it, I had to go back out and try it. And I got in a lot of trouble listening to fifth steps from 16-year-olds because there were a lot of things I hadn't tried. I found out how old I really was when I started sponsoring them chicks, let me tell you. So for the first 3 years in AA, I tried to get qualified to belong here because I really was too good to be in AA. I'd only slept with one man in my entire life. And I was in AA. Can you believe that? I mean, you can't qualify that way. It just doesn't happen. Little did I know it had nothing to do with qualifying to be here. And I soon resorted to drinking alcohol. I mean, it was easier to get. The doctors finally cut off my supply of drugs. I had stopped getting all the flowers and the back rubs and all the stuff that goes with being sick. I got addicted to hospitals. And that can happen. There might be some people in the room right now who fell in love with hospitals. They're a nice addiction to have. They're expensive, but if you have Blue Cross and Blue Shield, you can carry that on for a few years before they catch on to you. Because I got attention in hospitals. I got my back rubbed. I could push a bell and get a glass of orange juice and have clean sheets every day and get bathed, and I could track up and down the hall in a new robe and new pajamas and make new friends and tell any kind of story I wanted to tell, because 9 times out of 10 you're never going to see the jerks again anyway, so who gives a shit, right? That's the way I felt. I had a mixture of meeting people and being scared to death and hard as nails, all at the same time. The first time I drank alcohol, I thought I had committed the unpardonable sin. I mean, it was like hitting a bottom for me that I had never hit in my life. To walk into a liquor store, I didn't even know how to order a bottle of booze. I didn't know the names of things, so I went and got a Life magazine and paged through it until I found a liquor ad, and it was Smirnoff Vodka, and I did not know how to say Smirnoff. I just went, I don't know how to say that. So I took the picture in and showed the liquor store guy, I want a bottle of this because I'm having a party tonight and I'm entertaining. And I know he knew that I was lying through my teeth. And I took it over to the playground with a quart of orange juice, and I did not know how fast liquor got you drunk. And I drank a pint of vodka and a quart of orange juice in a hot summer day in July or August, riding on a merry-go-round at the park. Oh, my God, all I have to do today is talk about that to know, oh, how awful it felt. And I got toward the end of the bottles, and they weren't balancing out. And I don't know if I had more orange juice left or more vodka, but I know that they weren't right. And I decided that I had to go to the store to get whichever it was that I was out of. And this numbness started across my forehead and down the sides of my face, and that's the last thing I remember. I'm told that I went to the preacher's house, which would make sense since I wanted to be a missionary, and fell down his stairs drunk, but I don't know. I had no reason to doubt it, so I suppose I did. That was my first drunk. There was no indicator, however, that that was an alcohol problem for me. Because I still didn't have a 3 days growth of beard, and I still didn't have a trench coat, and I still hadn't urinated all over myself yet that I could remember. I've told that wasn't true, but I couldn't remember it. And that's the way my alcoholism went. I could always compare to someone who was worse than me and say, I'm not that bad, and I'm not an alcoholic, and besides that, I'm still singing in the Nazarene Church Choir. And the morning that I fell out of the Nazarene Church Choir, head forward, gave me a little indicator that we were losing ground fast. I just felt myself swaying, and I thought, oh, my God, I hope I am not as dizzy as I think I am. And about that time, I just pitched straight forward and fell out of the choir. So I got asked not to sing in the choir anymore, and I didn't. And so then I beat the stained glass window out of the church because I was angry at them. And besides, they were locking me out anyway, and I thought that the house of God should always be open to those who need it. You know, we are responsible when anyone, anywhere. That's AA, not the Nazarene Church, I found out. And so that was me up until I was 23 years old. My values were all messed up. I would have an ultimate goal, but I could never get there. I did not know about progress. All I knew about was perfection. And if I set a perfect goal and didn't reach it, then I just obliterated myself with a big red X in the form of a bottle of pills, a bottle of booze, a razor blade to my wrists, a gun to my mouth. Whatever it took to forget jumping out of a car going 60 miles an hour, there was no regard for myself, none. I was willing to pay any price to do what I wanted, have what I wanted, get what I wanted, where I wanted, and how I wanted it. And most people in my life weren't willing to go that far, and so I found myself very isolated and alone. The higher the price I was willing to pay, the more people I lost in my life. I soon found that I had no kids. I still had the villain of a husband, but if that's what you could call it, it was in name only. I had been in 55 hospitals in the previous 5 years, and I only know that because my husband kept stubs of them. This was a different husband, by the way, than Fred. Fred didn't do this. And he would flash those things in my face and let me know every time I'd been to the hospital that this was one more time that he had taken care of me. I wanted to put Velcro on the back of his hand so I could just slap him up on the Velcro cross every time he did the Al-Anon salute, you know. Whoa. The first thing I learned in Al-Anon was how to get that hand down off of my head. And so I finally ended up in Larned, Kansas, in the center of the universe there at the Kansas State Mental Institution. I didn't work in it. I was an inmate in it. That's, and I still didn't meet Fred there, but that's where I resided for a while, at the Larned Hilton. And, you know, I think that at least this alcoholic has always had a sense of pride. I'm not going to be shamed. I might be a mess, but I don't want to be shamed. I don't want to be ashamed. I don't want to be humiliated. It's pretty hard to be in the state nut ward and not be humiliated. But I did it because I decided, like we can decide, that fast, the whole scene was there. If we could ever get some of this stuff down on paper, I could sell these playwrights. I've done so much script writing in my life just to survive, that I decided that I was a writer for a major magazine, and that I was there doing research on the state hospital, and that I could not do that unless I really was being treated like a patient in the state hospital. So that's what I told everybody there. I'm a writer, I'm doing a story, and I'm here for the duration, and when I get out, you'll probably see my story in Life magazine. And those dope heads believed me. I mean, you know, so I was a celebrity on the nut ward, and I loved it, you know. But one of the women there got a hold of my story and started reading it, and it was about 365 pages long by that time. And she said, "Have you ever been to Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I said, "Why would I go to Alcoholics Anonymous for?" And she said, "Well, because I have a feeling that you have a problem, and besides that, they have free coffee, free cigarettes, and men." So I went to my first meeting. And I never went back. You know, they had cigarette butts. They had instant coffee. And if she called what I saw their men, you know, I... whatever. So I never went back. And I finally learned to play that game. And I got out of there. And that was in October of 1966. I was 24 years old. I had lost everything I had. A judge had promised me that I would never see my kids again. My mother had told me that if I ever saw one of my siblings on the street, to please do her a favor, to walk across the street and act like I didn't know them, and to never darken her doors again. And so I didn't have a lot of choices left. When I got out of the hospital, I had enough medication for 3 months, which was about 360 pills, I think. And that was on the 17th day of October, 1966. On Halloween, which is something like yet less than 2 weeks later, I was out of drugs. The medication was all gone. The gremlins got it again. And I loaded 22 rifle, had my brother-in-law load the 22 rifle. I didn't even know how to do that. Went down to the Nazarene church and said my prayers and said my goodbyes to God and made my tour through the church doing what you do when you're going to go kill yourself in the basement of a church. I didn't have any training for what to do. So I just did what I thought you should do. And I went downstairs and stuck the gun in my mouth and found out it's very hard to pull the trigger on a 22 rifle when you got the barrel stuck in your mouth. So I finally did that with my toe. I'm very flexible, so I got my toe up there, pulled the trigger, and died. And I was glad. Until I realized that the life after this life is exactly like this life I came to, and I was sitting in the basement of a Nazarene church in the bathroom with a gun on the floor between my legs, and I thought, I don't think this went real well. Well, it turns out I'd pulled the gun out of my mouth, and it discharged right over my shoulder and went through the wall, and in the door came the Nazarene preacher in hysterics, and I realized how pissed I was that I couldn't even kill myself. That was my third suicide attempt. And I just gave up. Now, I think I took step two right there, but I did not know that that's what it was. I just went, I don't have another neat idea. Not another neat idea. There's nothing in my head that I think will work. And yet, I still did not come to Alcoholics Anonymous on my own. From there, I continued to drink a little bit and got carried over to my dad's house 50 miles away, and he was in the program. By that time, I weighed about 230 pounds. I was living in the same clothes I'd been living in for 6 weeks. I had thrown up all over myself. The only reason I didn't have a 3-week growth of beard is because I can't grow a beard. And I looked just like the drunk that I thought a drunk looked like. I didn't have on a trench coat, but I had on a black sweatshirt, khaki pants, combat boots, and absolutely no ID. I had long ago decided to not be identifiable. That when they found my corpse, they were just going to say, here's a 230-pound white female in a black sweatshirt, green pants, and combat boots. Of course, with my head shaved, I think I probably, and I kept shaving my hair all off for some reason. I'm not sure why. It seemed like the right thing to do at the time. And I'm sure that I would have been identifiable, but I thought I wasn't. And I just was desperate. And I really believed that it was the end of the line for me. I got carried to my first AA meeting on December 19th, 1966. I do not remember getting there. I do remember coming to in the meeting, and I was laying on a table like that one back there. There were eight guys around another table, and they were just getting ready to say the Lord's Prayer, and I came to and sat up on the edge of the table just in time to hear them say the prayer, jumped down and thought, I don't know where I am. This is the weirdest Sunday school class I've ever been in. And then I realized that I was in an AA meeting because I had been in AA with my father. And that was my first meeting. Now, I thought I was there with my dad. And all the people came up to me and were saying, welcome, and we're glad you're here. And so I figured out I must be at my first meeting, which it turns out that I was. And I have never stopped coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous since. My dry date is August 27th, 1969. I will have 25 years of continuous sobriety if I do what I've done one day at a time for the last 24 years and some months. And I have no reason to believe that I won't. I don't intend to drink again ever in my life. That's my intention. Because I intend to keep doing what I'm doing now, which has been sufficient to keep me sober and to change my personality so that I don't want to drink. Drinking is not something that enters my mind as an option. I don't think, well, if this doesn't go well, I'll just have a drink. You know, if he doesn't straighten up, I'll just have a drink. I thought, if this doesn't go right, I might shoot myself. But drinking is not an option for me. And from there, I continued to do a lot of things. I loved AA because I found out I couldn't be thrown out of here. And every place else I had ever been, I could be kicked out. And they told me in AA that I was an AA member if I said I was. And I said I was. And so I was. And I love that. I love being able to say what I was, and you could not tell me that I wasn't. And I really went on that third tradition for a long time. I picked fights with it. I turned tables upside down with it. I told people, you can't put me out of here. I'm an alcoholic if I say I am. The meeting that Fred told those of you who were here earlier this afternoon, where my group met and decided to kick me out of AA and didn't invite me. When I heard about that, I was angry, and yeah, we started another group, but I just said, they can't throw me out of here because I know the third tradition. I didn't know the first step, but I knew the third tradition. The more that I hung around, you know, we talked about sponsorship earlier this afternoon on the panel. I didn't go up to any woman and ask her to be my sponsor. I didn't look around and find a woman that I wanted what she had. The first five groups I was in, there were no women. I was the only woman. There was one woman in one group, and she was 13 years sober on drugs, and she was in a hospital. I was in one group where there was a woman who came in and out periodically, but only to sober up after she got out of detox, and then she'd be back out drinking. But there was a woman 200 miles away who heard about me, because she heard about every woman that got sober in Western Kansas. She was 15 years sober, and she sponsored almost every woman that got sober. So she was like Sybil was out here in the good old days. Olga sponsored every woman that sobered up until she could get one to stay sober long enough to let them sponsor someone else, which if you could make it a month, she was glad to give you somebody to sponsor. And she just came and was my sponsor. I don't know who she heard about me from, but I'm sure the guys always called Olga up and said, we got a wet one in our group, so can you get to Liberal, or can you get to Garden City, or can you get to Coolidge, Kansas, or Holly, Colorado, or wherever on the eastern slope of Colorado and the western part of Kansas. Olga sponsored all over the country. And she found me. So that's who was my sponsor. I didn't know enough to say no. I just thought that that's the way it went in here. You know, she was a graduate from the Genghis Khan School of Sponsorship, if you've ever met one of those. That I think she started it, actually. And so she just took me under her wing with a blend of firmness and compassion and was my sponsor. She scared the hell out of Fred in the first 3 years that she was my sponsor. It was like the play this afternoon. Every time anybody would start to get close to me that wore trousers, she'd have them, you know, batting them away. Although, that really was never that big a problem with me. When you weigh 230 pounds and you won't change the clothes that you've thrown up on for 6 weeks, even when you're in AA, and bathing is not part of the program, so you don't see why you have to do it. There's nowhere in the big book that says I have to take a bath or shave my armpits or my legs or any of those things if I don't want to, and I let my sponsor know that. I wasn't chased around the tables a lot by the guys here. It just was not a major problem. But I used to like to think I was. But she was my teacher. Augustard started setting me in an opposite direction about alcoholism, what it is, the nature of it. You know, she got me into the book and she let me know that alcoholism has nothing to do with, absolutely nothing to do with, comparing how much I drank to how much you drank. I know people who drink more booze than I ever drank that are not alcoholic. They may have a drinking problem. Some of them don't even have a drinking problem. They drink wine with spaghetti. They drink wine with dinner. They'll have a beer with pizza. They can have nightcaps. They can toast weddings and funerals and whatever people toast, and they are not alcoholics. So it was not about the amount of alcohol that I drank. It was about what alcohol did to me and what I did in the face of the fact that I could not drink alcohol like normal people. I couldn't have one drink like a normal person. In the first place, I didn't think like a normal person about having the first drink. I did not sit down to a plate of spaghetti and say, I think I'll have red wine with this. Not one time in my life. I would go, well, I'm going to go spend $1,000 today, overdraw the account. I'm going to come home. The husband's going to beat the hell out of me again. And so I better have a drink to gear up for this. And I would go out and start drinking and start spending and come home and get beat up and drink some more and run away and shoot streetlights out. And that was my drinking. I had to have that perception of alcoholism changed because it was imperative that I understand the nature of my disease and the nature of what it did to me. I didn't know that I was obsessed. I did not know that those behaviors I did were obsessing. I also did not know that I had a physical allergy to any kind of substance that changes my mood. Had no clue. And I did not know that I suffered from a spiritual malady. When you're born and raised in the church and you sing in the choir and you teach Sunday school and you speak in tongues and you want to be a missionary, you do not think that you have a spiritual malady. So that didn't occur to me. I was totally in denial about my dilemma. And when Olga started explaining it to me and having me read the book, I didn't just whip around and go, oh, I get it. I ground my heels in and said, no, you don't understand. Not me. That's not my problem. And I would read the book and identify with part of it. And this is an illustration I often use so that I can just skip over the whole 3 years of time that I argued with and struggled with this program, never missed a meeting and drank the whole time for 3 years. Don't do that. If you haven't done it yet, I would strongly advise people not to do it. It's the most pain I ever went through in my life. But I was reading in the doctor's opinion, where she had me start reading at the beginning of the book, and I had gotten into the doctor's opinion, and I read that part about types of alcoholics, and it just threw me into a tailspin. There are five types of alcoholics. And I got down to the last type, which is the manic depressive alcoholic, who is probably the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could probably have been written. And I went ballistic. I went, I am the manic depressive alcoholic. I am the least understood by my friends. And I want the chapter to the manic depressive alcoholic. And I started looking for it, and there was no chapter. And that ticked me off. And I went, why do they mention a chapter and not put it in the book? And what kind of an idiot wrote this book anyway? And yeah. We got to remember it was a non-alcoholic doctor that wrote that chapter. No Bill W. would have ever put that in the book. But the doctor didn't know better, and so he put it in there. And I wrote to New York, and I did my ay-ay-ay about where's the chapter to the manic depressive alcoholic so that I can get well. And he wrote me back, he being Bill W., wrote me back and said, if you'll read the chapters that we did write, there's a good chance that you'll get sober anyway. But that's all I had to hear. All I wanted was an answer. You know, where's the chapter? Well, we didn't write it. Read what we did write, okay? Okay. You know, but that's the way I would get hung up. I mean, about stuff like that. I was thoroughly confused. I don't know what my motives were. I think I wanted to get sober as badly then as I did the day that I quit drinking. People have asked me, what's the difference? If you didn't quit going to meetings, I started groups while I drank. I started a conference that's still alive today. 26 years old, that I was still drinking when we started it. I was still drinking when I started the group, helped start the group that Fred and I started. And I did not miss meetings. So the only reason people drink again is not because they stopped going to meetings. And I know people that can come to meetings and never drink again and never recover. You know, I suffer from the symptoms of my disease, not the drunkenness of it. That is the least of what happens to me in my alcoholism, is the drunkenness, if nothing else changes. I've had people say to me, well, what's the difference? If you were coming to meetings for 3 years and you were starting groups and you had a sponsor and you were reading the book and you drank, and now you come to meetings and you have a sponsor and you sponsor people and you read the book and you work the steps and you don't drink, then what's different? The only thing I know is that I was finally able to grasp and develop a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty, which has changed my personality sufficiently that I no longer have to drink. How that happened, I do not know any more about than I know why these lights are on. To me, the lights are on because somebody flipped a switch and the lights came on, and it's that simple. And I'll tell you what, I don't lose a lot of sleep worrying about it. I don't care. As long as you flip the switch and the lights come on, I'm happy. And I had to get it that simple about my disease. I do not know why I am genetically put together or spiritually put together or emotionally put together to do what I do with life, and especially when I add alcohol to my system. I do know that I am a man or a woman, and now I know which. I am a woman who cannot control my drinking. And I certainly cannot control and enjoy my drinking. And that's all I need to know. If you are a man or a woman who cannot control and enjoy your drinking, then you are probably an alcoholic. And if you are an alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic, then the only solution for you is probably a spiritual solution. And I didn't like hearing that. I don't know about you. I wanted psycho-cybernetics. I'm okay. You're okay. I wanted any kind of meditation, upside-down meditation, transcendental meditation, yoga meditation, anything except having to do, and spiritual they were specific about. It didn't mean sitting down and doing 500 chants. You know, it didn't mean singing in the Nazarene choir. It didn't mean going to the altar one more time and getting doused one more time. They laid out a set of principles for me to do that were spiritual in nature, that would revolutionize my life. And every one of them to me were disgusting. The first thing that they told me I had to do was admit that I was an alcoholic, that I could not control my drinking, that my life was unmanageable. And you know, I just gave verbal assent to that to get my sponsor off my back. I don't know if you know the difference between verbal assent and agreeing. I just said, yeah, that's me. Inside, nothing changed. Except that something changed. Something changed just in the willingness to say, okay, okay, okay. Then I'll buy it that I am possibly an alcoholic. When I drink, I don't control it. When I control it, I don't enjoy it. When I enjoy it, I don't control it. And when I'm doing all of the above, my life is total roller coaster. And so I'll buy the fact that I am possibly an alcoholic. Even worse than that, I had to admit there wasn't a thing I could do about it. On my own, every idea I had ever tried, every move I had ever made, everything that I had ever tried to do did not work. And therefore, I was going to have to seek help from someone else. And not only was that scary to me, it was maddening. I mean, it was shameful. The trust issues all got in there. What if the person that I came to believe that could help me really couldn't? I made my sponsor God because I wanted nothing to do with this God that I had known in church and Sunday school. He had let me down miserably. But I just had a sponsor that was enough of a teacher that she said, if you will just simply do what I ask you to do, and that she told me she would not ask me to do anything that was not in line with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that just to give her a year and give her a chance. And somehow that didn't sound like a life sentence to me. It was like, all right, I can do this for a year, prove that she's wrong, and then get out of here. And there was a bit of surrender. My surrender, I don't know about yours, but my surrender did not just come by throwing up my hands, laying down, and going, okay, I surrender. It came in bits and pieces. And when I would get myself against the wall to where I couldn't do anything else, I would surrender. Olga took me through the steps. She made me take a look at myself. She taught me how to write my four steps. First time I did a four step, I wrote a dirty novel. And she just tore it up and threw it away and said, well, I read a lot of dirty novels and I don't need another one. What I need from you is a four step. And she showed me how to write. I write in columns. I still do it. You know, I write what my resentment is, what the cause is, what it affects. Then I turn the paper over when all my resentments are written and write where I was at fault, where I was frightened, where I was self-seeking, where I was dishonest, and what I could have done differently. And if I'm writing anything else than that, to me, I'm not writing a four-step Alcoholics Anonymous inventory, because the directions for me are there. Now, I write novels, and I don't write dirty novels anymore, but I write stories. I write Christian stories. I write for a Christian's magazine. I love to write, but I was not writing a four-step when I wrote that kind of stuff. She was a wonderful teacher for me. In the process, I began to depend on God as I understood Him. I began to depend on the principles of the program for my inner strength rather than depending on her. She's been dead for 14 years, and I don't think there's a day goes by that something in my life does not ring a bell about her, that I don't think of her, that I don't open. I still carry her picture in my wallet. I still remember probably more of what she taught me than I did when she was alive. But Olga never let herself become my higher power. She saw to it that I did not depend on her for direction, for at least not divine direction, not the kind of who I should go with and what I should wear and where I should work and whether or not I should buy a car or whether I should change jobs. By the time I learned to work the steps, I could make those decisions for myself. I run them by my sponsor. I talk about these decisions with the sponsor that I have today. But my sponsors don't make up my mind. And they're not my God with a little G or a big G, either one. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that I had that kind of direction and leadership in AA. When I got here, I was not good at relationships. To me, a relationship lasted 90 days. The longest relationship I ever had in my life, except with the man I married, was about 89 days. And, you know, when I got real honest, I used to say, well, who needs it? You know, who wants a man? Well, that just was a flip way of me ever getting down to whether I did or didn't. I think either answer's fine. If I look deep within myself and find out that I'd rather be alone, then more power to me. But when I sat down and looked at myself and looked at male-female relationships in terms of sexual, loving, romantic, I want to be with you, I want you in my life, I want to have your baby type of relationships, make no mistake about which kind of relationship I'm talking about here, I knew that I wanted a man in my life. I wanted a mate, I wanted to be with somebody, and I did not want it to be a different somebody every month of the year. That was not the kind of life I wanted to live. It's too exhausting, for one thing. And for another, these days it's too dangerous. Maybe it wasn't then, but it's just not what I wanted. And until I could rip away that deceit that I had going on in myself and stop making white males or any other type of male an endangered species, it was never going to happen. No, I had a resentment at the male species from day one. And in my inventory, I realized that I really wanted a healthy, wholesome relationship with the opposite sex in my life. And about that time, Fred came into the group that I was in, and I thought he looked like a perfect target. I just went, well, he's my age, he's clean, he's in a three-piece suit, he's got a blonde crew cut, his nails are clean. You know, he looks good to me. He drives a shiny car. He has what I want. Besides that, he would speak to me. Nobody else in my group wanted anything to do with me. They barely spoke to me. They barely tolerated me. And it was really, really nice to have somebody come along who liked me. And I began forming the first of a series of long-term relationships. I was working on a long-term relationship with my sponsor, and now I had one going with him. And it's a real adventure to stay in a relationship through thick and thin, whether it's with a sponsor or a sister or a mother or a husband or a child or whoever. And it was something I wasn't used to doing. When things got rough before, they would just stick me in a hospital and they would go on having a relationship. But to stay there, be there, not tuck and run, when things got too good or when they got too bad, was a new experience for me. I did not know how to dissent. I only knew how to fight. I didn't know how to disagree agreeably. I didn't know how to listen. Somebody earlier today said that they had to be taught how to have a conversation, a communication with another human being, and so did I. The only thing I could do is sit and tell you about me and tell you about me and tell you about me and tell you about me. And if you responded and said, well, I had a red car once, then I had to tell you about all the red cars I'd had and how much better they were than the red car you had. And I did not know how to dialogue. I had to be taught that. That's rather important if you want to have a long-term relationship, unless you've got a real sick person who just wants to hear about you all the time. And I don't know why Fred stuck with me. You should have seen the other woman in the group. I have an idea why. I looked bad, but she looked worse. And I think they said something about he ought to give up his old drinking friends, and so he just kind of buddied around with me. And besides, at that time, he was so much into people-pleasing that I think he just pleased me for about 3 years. But I thank God for him, because through having a relationship, and that, you know, our story just does not go with do not get involved with whatever it is you don't get involved with in your first year. That I'm all for that, for the people that do it and that it works for. But I'm not talking about my opinion, I'm talking about my experience, and my experience is not that. In my experience, I got involved with someone, and he got involved with me, and we stayed sober in spite of it. And we grew in spite of it, and we got through those things by working the steps and going to our sponsors and doing whatever it was we had to do. And so 25 years later, we're still here, and we're here together again and again and again. I mean, it wasn't a rose garden. We started groups together. I continued to work the steps. I got down to my sixth and seventh steps, and I decided that, well, that's jumping the gun a little bit. I went through a real turmoil about wanting to be married. And so I picked Liberal Kansas' most eligible bachelor who had committed for the rest of his life to never being married, and so that's who I wanted, of course. I mean, why not take on a challenge? And I decided that the one woman in the world that this man was going to marry was going to be me. The truth is, he's not only married me once, he's married me twice. So I'm quite happy about that. And I was relentless. I was as relentless in what I wanted in sobriety as I was in my drinking. And as he said in his story, annually I would ask him, do you think you're ever going to marry me? And he would say no, and I would cry for a month or two, and then we'd go together another year, and then I'd say, do you think you're ever going to marry me? And he would say, no, not on your longest day. I really like you. I like being sober with you. I like your kids. I like the kids' dog, but I don't think I ever want to get married. And I did that for 3 years, and finally said, you know, reality is reality, and I'm going to get out of here and go on and live my life. And it's so typical of the way things work in this program. The minute I gave it up, he had a diamond ring, stuck it in a hamburger patty. I was making dinner one night, and I was smashing out these hamburgers, and I ran into something, and I went, what's this? And I pulled it out, and it was a diamond ring. And I turned around, and he had this shit it and eaten grin on his face. And I said, what is this? And he said, well, what does it look like? And I said, it looks like a diamond ring. And he said, that's what it is. And I said, whose is it? I mean, I thought the grocer had lost it in the meat. And he said, it's yours if you will marry me. And so I did. And we didn't live happily ever after either. There is a story to be told about AA girl meeting AA boy, whether it's over the coffee pot or on AA campus or wherever. When it's good, it's wonderful. When it's bad, it's horrible. And it's not only horrible for us, it's horrible for our sponsors and their sponsors and our babies. And they all know when we're at it together, missing meetings and getting in a standoff, you know. We get the steps and the traditions and the concepts loaded up on each side, and we do an AA war with each other. You know, it's like, who can sling the most steps and the deeper meaning of the concepts of each other until somebody wins? And we do that. I don't know if any of you in relationships do that, but we've both been as involved in general service as being delegates, so we have a lot of ammunition to throw at each other. And if that doesn't work, then we call up our past delegate friends and get them involved, and it's just a heyday. But I'll tell you, if you can survive, I look at it this way. If Fred and I can stay sober through an AA relationship, we can stay sober through anything. Sometimes I wonder if I am recovering or if I'm just in AA mark and time, you know, like I have 24 years and so many months and so many weeks and so many days, and I go, am I different? Is this program really working for me? Am I just dry or am I sober? Am I of maximum use to God and my fellow man? And just recently I was reading the big book. Actually, it was as recently as this morning in my room. And Fred was making some notes, and we were passing the big book back and forth, you know, trying to act like we were getting prepared to give our pitches, which we never use our notes anyway, but it makes us feel prepared to do that. And I was thinking about the promises, and I thought, you know, that's a checkpoint for me to gauge whether or not I am recovering or not. And I realized that all I have to do, at least one of the things I can do, is stop and ask myself. In my sobriety, you know, it says if you're painstaking about this phase of your development, you'll be amazed before you're halfway through. This phase of my development means by the time I get through from the first through the ninth steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I've admitted that I am powerless over alcohol, that my life's unmanageable, that I've turned other people's lives upside down, that I'm not a one-ring circus, I'm not a one-man show, I am not an island, I don't have the know-it-all answers to everything, I have hurt other people. I do need to look at myself, account to myself, for myself, and to another human being, and look at the defects of character that make me behave that way, what I'm made up of. I'm selfish. I'm self-centered. I'm deceitful. I'm a cheat. Without the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, if I never took another drink in my life, I could destroy more lives than a dozen psychiatrists could put back together. Just from the isms of alcoholism. So if I've been painstaking about that, made my amends to the people that I have harmed, then I'm going to be amazed. If I'm not amazed, I probably haven't been painstaking about that phase of my development. And I want to tell you today in my life, I am amazed. I am amazed that I am the woman that stands here today looking like I look, dressed like I'm dressed, smelling like I smell, laughing like I laugh, not jumping out of cars. I don't have a gun tucked away here to use on anybody. I haven't carried a razor blade for quite some time. There are no pills stuck in my ears or anywhere else. You know, you can get in my purse. It's clean. Everything I'm carrying is clean. If I got body searched today, I have nothing that they're going to find. And I'm amazed because I never believed that I could live that way. The fact that I'm an outside an institution is amazing, not only to me, but to all the doctors that treated me. I can ask myself, do I know a new freedom? Just ask yourself, are you freer today than you were the day you walked in here? Free from what? Well, I know what day it is. I know where I woke up, sort of. I mean, I know that I'm somewhere near San Jose, California. I didn't go to the bathroom in the closet this morning. I went in the bathroom. Even though it was a strange bathroom, I could get there. I'm not, every time I see a car with a red light on the top of it, I don't duck down an alley. I'm not guilty. No, I know a new freedom. I'm not sitting around in a living room with the drapes all drawn with the kids in the other room trying to make peanut butter sandwiches. You know, today when my grandkids are hungry, I feed them. I'm free from that dark black cloud that used to hang over my head. Do I regret my past? Well, I guess not. I mean, I'm telling you about it, even my most recent past. I don't regret my past. My past in God's hands is the greatest asset I have. Why would I regret it? I don't know if you knew that before you came to AA, but I didn't. I thought my past was something to be put in a dark box and buried in a deep hole and lied continually about. Even make up a new identity, you know. Today, I don't regret my past. As a matter of fact, I thank God for my past because it got me where I am today. I don't want to live it over again, but I never want to lose sight of it in the rearview mirror of my life. Because that is what I have to share, not only with you people, but with myself. You know, think about it. When I'm in prayer and meditation, I often run through my past. I go, you mean this is the woman that hated her brothers and sisters, that was locked up in a loony bin, that was sticking a gun in my mouth every time I turned around, that could not face my brothers and sisters, that lied continually, that felt like there were monsters all over me. My mental agony was indescribable. And today, my past is, I have 4 grandchildren, I have 3 kids, I've been babysitting the grandkids, I've held down a job, I've been married to the same man on and off for almost with him 25 years. I sponsor on and off between a half a dozen and a dozen women. That's my most recent past. That's a nice past. So I don't regret any of my past. I don't regret the dark past, and I don't regret my most recent past, whether it's dark or light. I also want to say something else about my past. My most recent sober past is not always a good story. You know what I mean? I've done things in sobriety a long time ago, and I've done things in sobriety not so very long ago that are not things that I'd want to have to live with if I didn't have 12 or 24 or 36, however many of them I may choose to use, because I do believe in personally using the traditions and the concepts in my life. I do believe that everybody in my household has a voice and a vote, that divided we fall, united we stand, so every member of our family counts. We have a minority voice in our house. You know, if 4 people want something and 1 doesn't, we ask the 1 why, and then we listen. We don't try to tell them why they should not want it. They don't always reverse the vote, but we listen. And sometimes they do. And whether they're 3 years old or 33 years old or 53 years old, they have an equal voice. 3-year-olds get heard in our family. And I couldn't do that if I didn't know the traditions. We practice the concepts in our house. We know what good leadership means in our house because we've read the concept. And it doesn't mean taking a gavel and beating people to death with it. It means governing or serving by example. When I'm the leader in our house, I get followed because people like what I do, and when they don't like what I do, they call me everything that a white woman doesn't like to be called, and they tell me to go to a meeting and work the steps. So my family knows the difference between being governed and being served, and they would much rather be served, and they know that because they've been taught those things. But there are times in my life when I'm not doing it that well, and I hurt people. Or I lie to people. And then I have a dark past in my sobriety that's maybe only 2 days old. But you know the good news? The good news is that someplace in this fellowship is somebody that I can go to and do it all over again. Admit what I did. Accept it. Realize if I can't change it, I can't change it, but God can. Get honest about it. Write about it. Uncover it. Discover it and throw it away, like Chuck used to say. Uncover, discover, and discard. That's what we do. Peeling an onion. You know. And today I don't have to fall into a dark pit of interminable shame because sober I wrote a hot check or slept with the wrong man or lied to my sponsor or called in sick when I wasn't really sick, or the things that in my belief we all at least once in a while still do. For me to stand up here and tell you that I don't have to do the things that I used to do drinking is not honest. Maybe I don't have to, but I do. I still do things that I did when I was drinking. I don't do them as often. I don't do them as intensely. I don't do them sometimes as defiantly, and I admit to them sooner. I trust more. I have never done anything in my life that I couldn't go to Fred and tell him that I did. I was a chronic shoplifter for 31 years. Now, if you can add it all, you're going to know that went a little ways into sobriety. 20 years, to be exact. I was delicate shoplifting. And I would go to him and bring in my load of stuff that I had just done and go, well, I did it again. And he'd say, well, are you going to take it back? Are you going to make amends? Are you going to go back and pay for it? Which one of your cures are you going to use this time? And I've done all of the above. I've walked into stores and said, keep an eye on me. I'm a shoplifter, and I'll rip you off if you don't. And then I shop. And that ticks me off, so I go down the mall to a different store, and I don't tell them that I'm a shoplifter, and I rip their store off and go home. I mean, not anymore, because I don't shoplift anymore. But I don't shoplift. Only 3.5 years have I been free of shoplifting. Well, I got to tell you that the first time I admitted that behind a podium, I went into a shame attack like I had never had in my life. I said I will never speak behind a podium again, firing all my babies, and I'm never going to admit that I was delegate because I was so ashamed. Well, I'm either going to tell my story and hide my past and regret it, or I'm not. To me, it's black and white. You know, I can stand up here and tell you what I did drinking before I came to AA 28 years ago and not tell you about what I'm doing now. There are parts of my story that are not everybody's business. I have woman stuff that I'm not going to stand up in front of a group of men and talk about. But I have nothing in my life that somebody does not know the total truth about. That's probably why I'm not locked up in a loony bin, and it's why I don't have 400 razor blade slashes all over my body like I used to have, because I don't know if it's in the big book or not, but I know that it fits with the spirit of our program that I am as sick as my deepest secret. So when I don't have secrets, I can get on with my life. It does not make me perfect. It means that I have admitted to another human being what I've done, at least the exact nature of it. You know, the exact nature of shoplifting is I am selfish and self-centered and I want what I want even if I have to steal it. And I have no regard for you and what belongs to you, and that's the end of the story. Now, I went through the same steps working that out as I did drinking. And so today I don't regret my past and I don't want to shut the door on it. I do comprehend the word serenity. I used to think that serenity was just rollicking through life in a spiritual rocking chair with nothing ever getting in my face or in my way. Now, if that were true, I would not have a mother-in-law, and I wouldn't have a mother because she ticks me off, and I wouldn't have grandkids because they get on my nerves. Fred, I might have him part of the time. What I found out serenity for me is the ability to live with all of that, the ability to live with my life as my life is. If I want 7 siblings and everybody that they married and adopted and divorced and remarried and all of that hoo-ha and all my kids and who they married and my grandkids and my job and my coworkers and my boss and my AA friends, then there are times that things do not go my way. And so I have to practice principles of love and tolerance. It's just a must for me. That's what I have to do. But I pay the price because I want the results. Today I would say that part of my self-seeking has slipped away. I do realize that God is doing for me what I can't do for myself. And so based on that alone, even if I was only scientific and not spiritual, I would say that I am recovering, that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is working for me because the promises are happening in my life. The AA Big Book to me is not a novel to read to just put down and go, oh, hum, that was a great book or that was a crappy book or whatever kind of book you think it is. You know, it's politically incorrect and not neuter-gendered and gender-neutered and all that stuff. It's the Big Book. You know, I'm not for changing one word of that book. If God's a he, that's fine with me. Let's get on with the spirit of the thing and stop pole vaulting over mouse turds. That's my philosophy. I know it's not shared by everybody, but too bad. You know, I don't hear us arguing about changing what William Shakespeare wrote, so let's leave William Smith alone too. But if I'll follow the principles of that book and get my head off the self-will that I want it to be written like, don't we secretly all want to be the founder of AA, you know. If I'd been writing this book, we'd have, you know. So I got over that one, too. I cease fighting anything and anybody, and that includes the way Bill W. wrote the book, you know. And today, my life, well, I wouldn't trade it for anybody's life that's in this room. That's just where I stand, you know. I thank God for the fact that I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Today I have a family. You know, making amends has primarily boiled down to going back and picking up the remains of the family that I left behind. I've been in AA, I've been sober almost 25 years, and as we speak, I am making amends to a baby brother who is 16 years younger than me, who 7 months ago, when my favorite sister, my little one 13 months younger than me that I palled around with that did not see her life as I saw mine, and we just were best of buddies, decided to check out, and so she got in a car and hooked up a vacuum sweeper hose and turned on the gas and got her Bible and underlined a few scriptures and put herself to sleep. And I was devastated. And I was back doing her funeral because the family wanted me to do the funeral. And my baby brother came up to me and said, "You know, I've never had the courage to tell you this before, but I have wanted to be in your life all of my life. And I've realized that the way I'm going to have to do that is I'm going to have to get drunk and drink myself into Alcoholics Anonymous. And then you'll treat me like a newcomer, and you'll love me like I want to be loved. And I'm going to tell you that that is a silver bullet." There was no denial. There was no room for... I mean, I could have started all that yaya about, "But you don't understand, I was elected GSR, and I was elected DCM, and I was elected delegate, and they asked me to speak, and I can't say no, and the answer is always yes," and I say, bullshit. The answer is not always yes for me, folks. If I said yes every time somebody asked me to do something, I would never have time to do anything with the other things that have been given to me. When I said yes to everything, I didn't have time for family, husbands, children, dishes, jobs. Because for me, the more I say yes, the more I get asked. I'm an upfront type of person, and I get asked to do things all the time. And so I have stepped back. I go to meetings. I sponsor about half the people that I used to sponsor. And my brother went out and got tanked up on beer and drove 90 miles an hour down a dirt road, flipped his car 6 times. It threw him out, almost killed him. And he was in intensive care for about a month and just got out of the hospital. And I had him flown out here to Reno, and he's living with us right now. And I'm taking care of him. I feed him. I get him in the car and take him out. When I come home from work, I spend the evenings with him. And we're doing that for a couple of months because I want him to get well in a well environment. That is what I can do to make his life better for the things that I did that I didn't even know I did. And to me, that's what amends are about. They're not about muttering, "Oh, honey, I'm sorry, but you don't understand. I was 16 years older than you, and I left, and I didn't even know that you liked me, and na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na." There are things I can do. I can ask him, what can I do that will make your life better? And then listen. Not tell him what will make his life better. I don't know what will make his life better. He knows what he wants from me that will make his life better. And so that's what I'm doing. Is it inconvenient? Yes, it is. He's in our living room. We have to slide around him. I have more laundry to do. I can't come home and plop down in front of TV and uninterruptedly watch a television show because he keeps talking to me. But so what? It's like I said to Fred one time when we took the kids to the park and I didn't really want to go, and so I made the supreme sacrifice and we got the baby strollers and the tricycles and the bicycles and the diaper bags and backpacks and went to the park all day. And when the day was over, he said, "Now, didn't that feel good?" And I said, "No, it didn't feel good at all, but it sure felt right." And that's the story of my sobriety. You know, every time that I do something in Alcoholics correctly, it does not feel good. It has not always felt good to work the steps. It doesn't always feel good to call my sponsor. And it sure doesn't always feel good to answer my phone when my babies call me. Now, it felt good to come down here because this is like a vacation. It's a pretty drive. We got our way paid. We got a nice room. We get some fruit and pistachios and fresh cherries. And, you know, that I like to say yes to. But whether I'm sitting in a meeting with a drunk puking in my lap or whether I'm here in an upgraded AA meeting in clean clothes, standing behind the podium with the spotlight on me for a few minutes, it may not feel good, but it always feels right. Thanks.